His name.
We have a quorum. Do we have a quorum to start the meeting, Kwaliso?
Chairperson, we have. Just hold on. We have four members, Chairperson. It's yourself, Mr. Malachi, Ms. Powell, and Mr. Heron.
Okay. Can we get one more member to come in?
Okay. Hi, Chairperson, you can start now. We have two more members that just joined.
Good morning, honorable members and our guests. You're welcome to the meeting. Can we flag the agenda, Kwaliso?
Can you see the agenda, Chairperson?
Yes, we see the agenda. Honorable Power.
Before this agenda is adopted, may I please make a recommendation in the interest of saving officials' time that we move the consideration and adoption of minutes number 7 to after number 8, because that's an internal committee matter.
Yes, you're correct, Honorable Power. You're correct. Yeah, can we then move for the adoption of the agenda as amended?
I move the adoption of the agenda, Chair, as amended.
Thank you, Ms. Kwai. Can we get second?
Chair, it's Honorable Powell, I'll second.
Thank you very much, Honorable Powell, for seconding the agenda. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all of you, our guests, particularly the welcome to our Auditor General and the department led by the DM. I didn't see the minister. If he's in the meeting, we're welcome. You're welcome, Director General and the officials and the support staff of Parliament. You're welcome to this meeting. I'll invite you to observe a moment of silence for meditation or prayer. Thank you very much. Kwaliso, can we then note apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson. The apology that I have is from Ms. Buthelezi. She's still not well. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Kholiso. Let's move to item item. Is it three? Item number four. Take the opportunity to welcome the Auditor General, Mr. Londolozi. I hope today I pronounce it better. Mr. Londolozi, you're welcome to the meeting, and we want to take this opportunity to welcome yourself and your team. We have had some interaction with yourselves, and this is a follow-up meeting after the finalization of the special report as pronounced by the Auditor General. You're welcome, Mr. Londolozi, to take us through the presentation.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you very much for the invite. And good morning to the honorable members as well. Chairperson, I'm a little bit under the weather today, but I will soldier on. So Chairperson, I think before I start, both the Special Report 1 as well as Special Report 2, we would have previously shared our observations with the Portfolio Committee. So when we then got this invite, we sort of also deliberated as well to say, is the Portfolio Committee sort of looking at maybe a recap of some of the matters that would have been presented and reported in the special reports. So I think we then settled on giving an entire background and recap in terms of what we would have identified. And the reason being, Chairperson, is that you would remember that in terms of the special report one, so we would have performed work up until around September 2020. And that would have formed part of the special report number one. And towards the end of September, beginning of October, we then had engagements with the department, and a decision had been taken that the resettlement initiative, which it was referred to, would no longer be part of a response to COVID, and that it will continue as the normal program of the sector. Now, what that meant was that we would therefore no longer be performing COVID-related work in relation to the initiative. And as a result, any work that would have happened or taken place after that, it would have been follow-ups. And that's what has happened since September 2020, Chairperson. So my report is just a recap of what would have happened when we actually performed the actual work on the initiative from April 2020 up until September 2020, and the follow-ups after that. So the first slide that I want to maybe take the Portfolio Committee through is our reputational promise. And this is where we just confirm that, we exist to strengthen our democracy as a country by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector as a whole through our audits that we perform on an annual basis. And our role, again, is just to remind the Portfolio Committee members that our role when it comes to the reporting process around the BRRR is to really reflect on the work that we would have performed. So in this specific instance, it would be the work that we would have performed around the COVID-19 initiative. As I mentioned before, it was called the Resettlement Initiative or Program at the time. And again, because I didn't want to start in the middle of nowhere, Honorable Chairperson, I thought let's also just recap on the insights that came from the first special report, because this is the report where we would have performed the actual work on the ground and came up with observations. You will remember, Honorable Chairperson, that at the time we would have looked at a budget of around 1.4 billion for 95 projects. And we would then have looked at, that split would have been between permanent structures as well as temporary residential units. And obviously, 51% of that allocation was then what we are focusing on specifically for this presentation. And the spend at the time, it was around 30 June 2020. We then identified that the sector would have spent 123 million using the USDG and around 43 million on HSDG. So at a high level, when you look at the budget and what we had planned to look at, that would have been the picture at the time, Chairperson. And I think at a high level, the three main areas that we had scoped were around whether the appointment of service providers was in line with the Treasury regulations that would have been pronounced at the time that were specific to the response to COVID-19, whether in construction of these TRUs, you know, the sector would have used the approved price or unit price, as well as what the quality of those TRUs would have been. And the third area would have been around whether the beneficiaries that would then occupy those TRUs, were the relevant and the appropriate and approved beneficiaries. And at the time, when we completed SR1, we did identify that perhaps the speed in which the sector moved was not the requisite or was not of the requisite urgency. As a result, we couldn't confirm that indeed the sector was responding accordingly in terms of the COVID-19 needs. As well as I think I've mentioned that before, some of the projects or most of the projects that we would have selected, they had not commenced, and some of those that had started, it was literally at a very early age, and end of June 2020 at the time would have been the targeted period in which the response would have been in place. And also what we found at a very high level was that the budget and expenditure information between the three spheres of government was not readily available, and it did not correspond between the three areas of government. So we really struggled to get a proper picture in terms of what the budgets as well as the expenditure at the time was. And I think there was outstanding work, a lot of work that was outstanding that we couldn't perform because of the slowness in the implementation of the initiative at the time. Then the observations per the projects that we could identify. So the project plans, again, did not align with the overall plan for the sector, the sector that had devised in order to respond to the emergency. We found that the unit price was incorrectly used by the different projects. So there is an amount, a maximum amount that must be used, and that amount is broken down into different portions of the unit price itself. But you found that that was incorrectly used in the projects that we would have visited. And thirdly, the TRUs themselves that we would have audited at the time, were not occupied by the people that were approved. So that was another area that we picked up when we looked at the work in the TRUs. And we had recommendations where, and these recommendations, Chairperson, are recommendations that may not necessarily be specific for COVID, but we sort of came up with recommendations because these are the things that we are seeing, in the normal project life cycles of the sector as a whole. So we came up with recommendations where we're saying the coordination between the three spheres of government, it needs to improve greatly. And that is something that we are also seeing beyond the COVID-19 initiative. And the pricing itself of these units, you know, I think we then say that oversight, accounting officers should provide more oversight and coming up with processes to ensure that the price that is, approved per the policy is used correctly so that there isn't a risk of overspending per unit of these houses built by the sector. And again, when it comes to the beneficiaries, we are seeing not only with these TRUs, but again in the sector as a whole, that the beneficiaries that we find in projects may not necessarily be the beneficiaries that have been approved. So in terms of the responses by management and those that are charged with governance, there were areas in which we did not necessarily agree, or at least the accounting officers did not necessarily agree with our approach, and reasons were given. But we then reported on what we saw on the ground versus the prescripts, that are designed in how to implement these programs of the sector. We came up with an overall message at the time. And again, it's centered around the need for the sector when it's faced with the disaster, sort of alter the monitoring and the responses that it, so that if it's an emergency, we're saying the sector cannot use the normal monitoring processes. There must be some change to reflect the fact that there is a need for an emergency a response. So the sector cannot continue as if its business as normal. Again, in instances where there is a response to a disaster, I think as a whole, the project cycles, they need to be revisited because you can't have a project with this time or life cycle continuing as if it is no longer a response to a disaster which requires an emergency. An urgent response. So I think those are the things that we would have found at the time that, as much as this was a response to a disaster, some of the processes were not altered, to reflect as such. Also, the coordination between, again, this is something that I would have mentioned before, there was some fragmentation, in terms of what the different spheres of government within the sector were doing. So that process was not properly coordinated, and as a result, it was ineffective. And obviously, with all of that, there will always be a fraud risk where there is a weak coordination and a lack of accountability. And that was raised at the time as the observations that we would have made. What we then did, as I've mentioned, Honorable Chairperson, was that the initiative no longer became a response to COVID, but we couldn't leave it at that. We then said, because in SR1, we would have come up with the findings and recommendations, and the accounting officers would have made commitments. We then said, let's then go back and see what progress had been made in relation to those commitments and whether any of our recommendations would have been implemented. And that's when we then identify that at least in the Limpopo project, there was an investigation that was then conducted, requested by the National Department for NHPRC to look at the quality matters, as well as the involvement of SIU in terms of the fraud allegations around that project. And indeed, there were quality issues that were identified, and an SRU report came out of that. And in the Free State, there were steps, or at least the steps that were to be taken to rectify the sizes of those TRUs. We found that that had not been done. In the Eastern Cape, I think we have not identified any additional issues, Honorable Chairperson, that we can then report on in terms of the projects that were then identified and audited at the time in terms of the projects relating to Eastern Cape and Gauteng. But we had found a new issue, which again was around the procurement processes. So what we found was that in trying to come up with a service provider to look at the issues identified in the Limpopo project, that process of appointing that service provider was again not in line with the bidding processes. So we were just saying that even though the issue was to resolve matters that would have been raised, but the processes themselves were still not in line with the requirements of the laws and regulations in appointing the service provider. And I think we had also reported that the impact, at least that was achieved with the first SR, was again largely to highlight to those that are charging governments early warning signs, in relation to the initiative itself. And I think because of that report, there were some projects that then had to be stopped and no longer continue, which is something obvious that we would commend the sector on. So at least that process or audit of the COVID-19 initiative did sort of stop some of the projects that would have been problematic going forward. And it allowed the accounting officers to also then come up with processes to rectify any issues before the project could get off the ground. The remaining risks, Honorable Chairperson, largely it is around the sector and the lack of processes to effectively implement, monitor and coordinate sector plans. And this risk is not only, again, I want to stress, only on the COVID-19. It's still there, even in the normal processes of the sector. So this is something that we report on even in the normal sector work that we perform, that the coordination is still not where it should be, Honorable Chairperson. So last year, again, I think this slide, Honorable, is a summary of what we would have presented in the November, I think it was the November BRRR session that we had. So this slide just literally summarizes what I've just taken through the portfolio committee in relation to what would have happened up until the BRRR session we had last year, November, Honorable Chairperson. And I then thought it would be prudent, Chairperson, to say now that that is the picture and the background around the COVID-19, both SR1 and SR2, there were also recommendations and key root causes that we then identified in the entire sector. And we thought perhaps let's also use this opportunity, although we were requested to talk to the SR, Honorable Chairperson, let's also use this opportunity to remind the Portfolio Committee of some of the recommendations that we would have made in that BRRR. Just to get a sense of whether the Portfolio Committee itself has been following up or has been tracking these recommendations. And this was largely because of a question that would have been raised at the time to say, how does the Portfolio Committee assist in improving the environment in the sector? So because we would have given recommendations, Honorable Chairperson, I thought let me use this opportunity to also just remind yourselves as the Honorable Members of what you can then track and maybe follow up with the sector in terms of how far they are in terms of those recommendations. And I think Even at the time, the major one that I stressed on would have been around the preventative controls. Just to say, are the accounting officers and authorities strengthening their preventative controls, in terms of their environments? The financial statements will be submitted for audit in May, and one of the recommendations was around the review processes of those financial statements and performance reports. So accounting officers and authorities have got the responsibility, and this is a recommendation, to ensure that the review processes around those financial statements is as strong as they should be, in order to eliminate chances of identifying or of us identifying material misstatements. The action plan, by now, all entities and the department should have developed action plans in response to last year's audit outcomes. And those action plans by now should have been being implemented in order to avoid the findings from prior year. And I think another key recommendation was around the filling of critical positions. So this is something that the portfolio committee can follow up with those that are charged with governance to ensure that the critical positions in all the entities and the department by now should have been filled. And excuse me. So this year again, Chairperson, it's we would have discussed this. It's taken directly from the BRRR presentation we had in November. Again, it's similar recommendations and follow-ups. Again, just to remind the portfolio committee of the role you can have in tracking these recommendations and finding out now already before the financial statements and the performance reports are finalized, to see how far the portfolio would have gone in implementing these recommendations. And lastly, Chairperson, I thought, because we are saying that the strongest control, or at least recommendation, is around the implementation of preventative control. So I thought, let me also add a slide or two to my presentation, just to remind again the honorable members what we refer to when we talk about this preventative control. So this is a controlled environment, so a typical business process environment. So what we are saying is that you need to have a strong control environment, and this can be done by the senior management in any entity or department. And this is a responsibility of the accounting officer, accounting authority, to ensure that these preventative controls are in place, and with the support of internal audit as well as the audit committees. So overall, the responsibility of the accounting officer and the authorities to come to make sure that the control environment itself is strong, and management will then be responsible for implementing those control or controls, or those strong controls, and then with the assistance of the internal audit and audit committees. And you will then see, Chairperson, that what we are saying is that the if there are no preventative controls, you will then see a continuation of financial losses being incurred, having the sector conducting investigations, where there will be disciplinary processes that will have to be instituted, and in certain instances may even lead to litigation within the portfolio itself or the sector. So what we are saying is that if the preventative controls themselves are strong, then the sector would then avoid all of these consequences, because this come after the effect. But what we're saying is the controls should be there in place to avoid having to go through these processes. And the last slide talks to what really makes up a strong preventative controls. You will see, an honorable member, that it is around leadership, you know, that inspires a culture of ethical behavior. Again, the adequate and sufficient skills, because what we are saying is that you will not be able to implement any controls that the accounting office and accounting authorities come up with if you don't have the sufficiently skilled officials at a management level to implement those controls. Policies. The policies need to be up to date across all the entities, and they need to, you know, capture the current environment within which the department and the entities operate under. There must be strong mechanisms that allows for officials to report any pressure or untoward pressure and influence on them. And obviously the risk assessment becomes very critical, and entities must be able to demonstrate how they would have responded to the risks identified. And lastly, this is where the assistance of internal audit and the audit committees come in, where you've got a strong combined assurance model. So these are the things that Honorable Chairperson, we felt perhaps let's also just include in the presentation, as much as the request was around the special reports, but these are things that affect the sector and things that the portfolio committee should be tracking, and if it's done before the finalization of financial statements and performance reports, then it might go a long way in assisting the sector improve in its overall outcomes. Thank you, Chairperson. That is my presentation for today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Londolozi, for the presentation. You would remember that in the last meeting when we interacted, there was an issue of the PPEs, and you indicated that you would come back on those issues, because at that time you're focusing on the TRUs. I'm not sure whether you can touch on that, so that we allow members to interact with the report.
Chairperson, the issue of the procurement of PPEs, that would have to form part of the regulatory or regularity audit, which will then commence after the 31st of March. So. The procurement itself should form part of the audit that is coming now. So at this point, those audits would not have started, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Londolozi. Members, any clarity-seeking questions? Honorable Powell.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chair, when we approved our program a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about this item being on the agenda for today, and the question was asked why it was on the agenda again, given that we've already had presentations by the AG in respect of this special report that was tabled in June of 2020, noting that it is now March of 2022. We have just received a presentation, and I noted the opening remarks of the Auditor General in respect of this presentation being given for a second time. And essentially, it's a duplication of what has already served before this committee. What we should be calling for as a committee, and this has been discussed, is the SIU report into all of the findings that have been made. You'll note that that report was given to the president in December and it was made public in February, and it contains a number of rather scathing findings in respect of what was contained in this special report. And Chairperson, I'd also like to bring to your attention that this committee is still waiting for the NAHBRC's report into the irregularities at Tulana, and obviously note that this matter has had findings in respect to the SIU's investigations that have been touched on by the AG. Can you give us an indication as to when we will be able to interrogate that report? And then I note again that at the Lindum Contour TRU, steps according to this presentation have still not been taken to rectify. I don't know when this is at. Is this at June 2020 or is this in March 2022? And again, noting from the presentation today that the sector, aka the DHS, continues to lack processes to effectively implement, monitor, and coordinate sector plans, which is a finding that we as a committee noted in our BRRR that has already served before Parliament. So Chair, we've got over 42 state officials and parliamentarians gathered in this meeting. I'd just like to understand what the purpose of this presentation today was, and when we can interrogate the meat that has resulted from these findings over now 18 months ago, in terms of calling the SIU before this committee to go through the findings. I'd just like it to be noted that it seems that this has been a little bit of a waste of time. There's nothing new being presented to us this morning. Thanks, Chairperson.
Any other hands, members? No other hands. Honourable Member, it's not a waste of time. you'd know that today, after the Auditor General, we are going to interact with entities, and you'll see in the next item, in terms of the program, all the entities will be coming, and including the department, including the NHBRC, to come back to the committee to report on the findings of the committees. So because of it's important for members to understand that this is where we are, this is where we should be taking the process towards. And there is if you look in terms of our program towards the end of September, all entities will be appearing to the committees. It's just today we have started with the three, which are CISOs and HFC and what else is that, Coliso? Yeah, there are two. And therefore, in the next, if you look at into the program, they are still coming to respond on issues of Auditor General, issues that Auditor General has raised as the findings in the special report, in the ordinary, in the BRRR reports. All those entities will be coming to respond to those issues, and in terms of their action plan, whether they actually deals with the root causes of issues that were raised by Auditor General, and we're still going to interact with those issues. It's not a waste of time. It might be a waste of time for you, member, but for other members, I think it's important that they understand where we are in terms of the special report and the second report as finalized by the AG, and including issues that we have dealt with the special BRRR. So those issues are there in the program, honorable members. So let me thank the Auditor General and allow the department to come in to present on the
on the entities that are on. Who's that?
It's called Socha. There are two hands.
Okay, I didn't see them. Honorable Sifai and Honorable Buta Seki.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. And also, thank you to the Auditor General who consistently remind us about what is good governance. And I think the presentation that has been made to us today is not for the first time. But it is important for us that we continue to reaffirm what is correct, what is just as the committee to the department. So I think please continue to tell us where we are not biting in terms of presenting good government programs and procedures to our systems. The Auditor General has raised two pertinent issues, Chair, about the TRUs that are not occupied. Some of them are occupied by not necessarily correct beneficiaries. Maybe the department would help us on the process and the procedure to have a relevant beneficiary in a house. Do you know, Chair, that communities that are in dire need of houses that are within the project, many of them, they died because of depression. When I know that I'm supposed to have a house and I do not get a house, start to have anxiety, depression, and the families lose their loved ones because of this problem. It cannot be the government. It can't be the government processes that undermines our people. So I think it's important that we get the process and procedure. How best can we address these particular issues? It's not a small thing not to get a house when you know that you're supposed to get a house. Not a small thing. It's killing family members. The other one, Chair, is the issue of, I think the Auditor General continues to talk about the lack of coordination, the lack of systems that does not speak to each other. You know, that starts from the department or from the company or the organization internally. Program 1 does not speak to program 2, 3, 4. They don't speak together. And they will not be able to achieve the objectives of government and of that organization if they speak in silos. I think this matter is very critical. Creating systems of systems that must speak together is very important. I think perhaps we need to know, where do we lose the trend and how best can we improve this particular issue? Chair, I think those are the few issues that I wanted to raise. Thank you very much.
Honorable Seki.
Chairperson, just mine was to say, let's note the report, Chair, as a progress and move. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Seki. Honorable Powell.
Chair, just on Honorable Seki's point, I support as moving. But noting that this is not a report on progress, this is a duplicate report that has already served before this committee roughly a year ago. Thanks, Chair.
Can we get Auditor General comment and then we move to another item? And Chair, and we appreciate...
My apology, Chair, my apology. I'm worried on how Member Powell is putting it, because we'll argue again in the minutes, Chair, to say what was the minute saying? I think the commonality is that we move, noting, of course, some points Comrade Sloy have raised, so that we should not come and argue again.
Okay. Auditor General?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, for the questions around beneficiary and lack of coordination. On the beneficiaries, there is a process, Honourable Member. However, what you then find is that when you go on the ground, those allocations are not made in terms of the processes as designed by the prescripts. So the main issue then, which is what we then recommend, is to say the accounting officers, it is their responsibility to then ensure that what is documented as the approved process of allocating beneficiaries is indeed what is applied. So from what we have observed, it really is around the implementation, Honourable Member. So in terms of the processes, yes, there may be needs to you know, strengthen the process itself, but the process is there. It's about how it is then implemented. So that's what we are raising for the sector. And in terms of the lack of coordination, and this has been a discussion for the past 3 years or so, it starts with having common indicators, as you would have mentioned. So currently, or at least the National Department is working on that, but the lack of customized indicators is a big contributor towards this lack of coordination. There isn't a process, even if you look at the spending itself, the budget spending. So the information that gets submitted to National, we cannot reconcile to information that perhaps our colleagues at the provincial Auditor General offices, confirm. So that also is an issue around, what gets submitted to National by the provinces not being necessarily valid, accurate, and complete. So that is the challenge, Honourable Member. And we are saying that it should start with having same indicators. And these indicators must then be anchored around the requirements of the MTSF. Currently, that is what we are seeing, is that that's not happening at the level that it should be happening at. I hope I have answered the questions, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Auditor General. Honorable Zeki, your hand is still up, or is it the legacy hand? Honorable Zeki?
No, it's an old hand, my lady.
Okay, thank you. thank you very much, Mr. Londolozi, for your presentation and for your reminding of issues, and we took note of all the issues that you have raised, which we'll continue to make follow up with the department. Thank you very much. Let me take this opportunity to welcome DM and the team to take us through the next item.
Good morning, Chair. Allow me to switch off my radio. I'm in the rural area, and I'm only showing my face so that you see it's me. Thank you very much. Chair, let me start by greeting you and all honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, the Director General Mulelo Changana, the CISOs led by CEO Advocate Mkhize, the NHSC led by Acting CEO Mr. Gordon, and the DDGs present today, and all officials. Chair, allow me, before I ask the two presenters to do their presentation, to make few comments on the report by Auditor General. I do want to take it as very useful for me, and just to promise that some of the issues raised by the Office of the Auditor General, we are already working on them, like the one filling of the critical positions. You will understand, Chair and Portfolio Committee, that we've now filled and also have the board members of all the entities, and there's gonna be, or let me say, there is stability of all the entities at the moment as we're speaking. And the second issue that I would like to raise from the Office of the Auditor General is the issue of the quantum, which in our MINMEC, we saw it as something that we need to work on it as the department, because initially that was made for the emergency. But these days you'll find that a person will wait. I'm going to what the Honorable Nancy Sroy was raising. A person will wait for a year, and it's not supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be once off an emergency that will immediately work on it. But we are trying with the minister that once it's no longer an emergency, once it takes more than a week, we say you can't wait for a year and be given a TRU. And we are fighting with the MECs of the provinces that let's make sure that rather than jumping for TRUs, we make sure that we come up with a permanent solution than a temporary solution. And some of the issues like the investigation by Limpopo, we are aware of that, waiting for the outcome. And we are happy and also thank the Office of the Auditor General, and also taken serious the issues and the recommendations that were raised by Auditor General. So we are working on some of the recommendations raised. Coming to the entities, as requested, the Department of Human Settlements team is here this morning to brief Portfolio Committee on the implementation of audit outcomes for the community scheme ombud services, that is CISOs, and National Housing Finance Corporation, NHFC. Chairperson, the Portfolio Committee will recall that no long ago, CISOs was struggling and not necessarily stable. In her turnaround strategy, the minister responded to this, and things quickly improved, as I said. The entity now has a new board, and there is a lot of progress, Chair. I promise that you will see for yourself that now there is a change, there is progress now. CISOs today has promising news to report, Chair, when they do their presentation. They've put in place long-term interventions to deal with issues raised by Auditor General. Of the ages, 26 findings, 13 are green, meaning they've been dissolved. 9 are in the process of resolution, and 4 of which are now hanging fruits. They are on red, you will see it. And I want to request the presenter to explain further on the issues where there is red, and it is because they are dependent on financial year end to be dissolved. Financial year end is end of March, as we're saying. You might not get the results now, but that are those that are going to come at the end of the year. Chairperson Sussos unfortunately relied on a trust relationship, hoping that all community schemes would register, which led to loss of revenue. I think it's something that was raised. I still remember then it was Comrade Seki when was commenting on this revenue issues. And to deal with consequence management, the entity has established an independent loss control committee, which make us very happy, Chair, because at that time, they didn't have such. And there's a lot that we'll hear from them, Chair, without wasting time. The DG has asked me, I don't know if he's still here, he's traveling from Joburg to East London. He said if he's here, he will comment, but if he's not here, I'm going to ask DDG to say something and Ngongo, because he's responsible for all the entities. And then I will then, after that, ask the DG, if DG is not here, to introduce the team and also introduce the presenter. And then the presenter must immediately do the presentation. Can I check if the DG is here? It looks like he is not here, Chair. Can I ask DDG Ngongo to then take over and introduce the team and also and hand over to the presenter? And thank you very much. DDG Ngongo.
Thank you, DM. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. Let me then introduce Advocate Mukize, who is the Chief Ombud of the CISOs, to take the Portfolio Committee on the presentation. We'll have the inputs at the end. Thank you, Advocate.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, Honourable Deputy Minister. Our colleagues from the departments and the heads of administration and our sister entities that are represented here today. As indicated and as introduced, my name is Boyce Mkize. I'm the Chief Ombud for the Community Schemes Ombud Service, in short, the CISOs. We are appreciative of the opportunity to present to the Portfolio Committee progress that has been registered in relation to the audit remedial actions and the improvement plans flowing from the Auditor General's findings in the previous year. Honourable Chair, I am joined in this presentation by our Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Thembelihle Mbatha, with whom we will share this presentation at your permission and indulgence. I just need to highlight a few overall issues pertaining to the findings that have been made by the Auditor General. Just to rehash, and I'm indebted to the Deputy Minister for her apt summary of the issues within the CISOs. Indeed, yes, I confirm that the CISOs is on a new trajectory in terms of transforming its systems, its processes, and ensuring that there is ongoing compliance with the legislated frameworks and that all of its systems, including internal controls, are appropriately strengthened. We are looking into a number of improvements that have already been introduced to address some of the shortcomings that were identified in the Auditor General's report. I may just indicate for the benefit of the Honourable Committee Members, Chair, that the audit finding or the audit opinion in relation to the CISOs for the previous year was that of a qualified audit opinion. This was a slight move from the previous year's adverse audit opinion, which basically indicated that there is some slight movement towards a desired state. We are not there yet, Honourable Chair and Members, because of the reality of the systems and some of the breakdowns that we had inherited prior to assuming office. I must indicate, Honourable Chair, that in terms of the qualified audit opinion, the basis thereof was largely premised upon the fact that the CISOs had not accounted fully for the entire universe of the community schemes that are supposed by law to register with the CISOs. I must indicate that in terms of Section 59 of the Community Schemes Ombuds Service Act, there is an obligation for all community schemes to register with the CISOs. We encountered twofold or challenges in two areas in the main with regards to this. The first is that our legislative framework, in as much as it creates an obligatory requirement for schemes to register with the CISOs, it nevertheless lacks the enforcement mechanism to actually ensure that the schemes in fact are in fact enforced and do comply with that particular legislative obligation. A matter that we are dealing with the department, and hopefully in due time it will be coming through to your good committee, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, so that we can strengthen our legislative framework to deal with consequences for schemes that do not register, so that the CISOs has got teeth in terms of the enforcement regime. This is one particular area that is has proven to be a fundamental weakness. So it contributed quite significantly to schemes not necessarily following through on the legal requirement for them to register. The second contributory factor, Honourable Chair and members, is that of a lack of a profile of CISOs, in the sense that the CISOs was hardly known in terms of its ambit, in terms of its mandate, in terms of its jurisdiction. And because of the lack of profiling of the CISOs, this created difficulties in terms of some of the schemes, in fact, being completely ignorant, even of the legal requirement to register. We have addressed this, Honourable Chair, through an aggressive advocacy campaign that we have already instituted. We've already seen some major improvements in terms of the profile of the CISOs and it being in the public domain. This is already bearing fruits in terms of some of the schemes coming through based on our advocacy and marketing campaigns. These are going to accelerate in the new financial year, and we are certain to register good progress in this regard. I may also add, Honourable Chair, that part of what we are looking into is to ensure that all the schemes that are registered in the country have got a database that can be shared between ourselves and the structures such as the BIDS office, so that there is alignment with those particular offices. In this regard, I'm happy to report that we've already signed a memorandum of understanding and agreement with the DIS office and other related entities for us to be able to share in their data and ensure that these are in fact synchronized, so there is no scheme that is left unaccounted for. We are in the process also of finalizing a technical opinion that is going to deal with the issue of GRAP implementation or interpretation, particularly with regards to accounting for the complete universe of schemes. The qualification, in fact, Honourable Chair, emanates from the fact that if we don't account for the full universe of schemes, owing to the two reasons I've alluded to earlier on, then the PFMA section that deals with the entity collecting all revenue that is due to it then kicks in immediately. And therefore, it became a financial issue of saying, if you cannot account for all the schemes, then it simply means you are not able to be true to the provisions of the PFMA that require each entity to collect all revenue that is due to it. So that's where the issue of the qualification came from. A number of sub-elements to that particular area than cropped up in relation to this issue. But the nub of the qualification was centered around this area of not being able to account for the complete schemes universe. I was indicating prior to this point that we, in fact, have also not just entered into those agreements. We have now moved on to appoint a service provider who is going to enable us to help with data cleansing of schemes, because part of what we discovered was that some of the schemes are duplicated and some of the schemes bore similar names, et cetera, which really confused the system and distorted our ability to account truthfully in terms of the complete universe of schemes. So that's the one aspect of intervention which is underway. And the other has to do with a process which we've already obtained a report on through an entity called Lightstone. They have provided what we call a geomapping of schemes. We now have data that gives us a full view or picture of the complete schemes universe in the country, reflecting also the geomapping of those schemes, where they are located with the GPS coordinates, which will then enable us to kick into the next phase of the program as we start the new year of actual physical verification of the schemes and physical enlistment. This will accelerate our ability to get all the schemes on board. The other intervention in this regard I may mention has to do with a systems development program that we have adopted, which has to do with the digitization of our processes. This will enable schemes to remotely load their documents through an interactive web-based system. We have an external service provider that has assisted us in terms of the development of the registration model. They will be developing other modules as we go along, including customer relationship management, as well as the disputes management system. All of these are going to create a platform for an integrated, digitized environment for the CISO, so that we then interact with our stakeholders in real time and are able to actually account for all those that perhaps may not have been accounted for. And this also includes a process of issuing out levies and bills to our customers, something that will be the first in the history of the CISOs, because previously it was basically a relationship based on trust, as the Honorable Deputy Minister indicated. And so schemes would come through, but there's been no billing, there's no statement of accounts, et cetera, that were issued. These are issues that we are correcting. And so we have registered great progress, Honorable Minister and Honorable Deputy Minister and Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, in terms of setting up a frame and a platform from which we can then institutionalize good controls and good corporate governance in this regard. Of course, the other areas have to do with the consequence management and loss control, and the CFO is going to address those. And the other areas have to do with the issue of disclosure notes. She's going to address those as well in terms of what these meant, in terms of the AG remedial actions. But we can confidently say that of the findings that were made, we have addressed to completion 13. Those have been addressed to completion. We've got 9 that are ongoing, and they are ongoing simply because of the nature and the character of those items. And they will in due course be finalized as well, coupled with the interventions and initiatives that I've just alluded to. And of course, we've got the last area, which is the red flagged items. And those are red flagged items because they have not yet fallen due in terms of the time for which they are supposed to be handled. And these are dependent on financial year end processes. And so the CFO will just address, with your leave, Honorable Chair, some of the key issues that I've just highlighted in broad strokes. to then finalize this presentation, and I will come back to then conclude. With your leave, Honorable Chair, may I then hand over to the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Thembelihle Sambatha. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chief Ombud, and good morning to the Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, as well as Honourable Members of the Committee. If I can check if everyone is able to see my screen. Okay, thank you. I'll just take you through the detail of the presentation, as the Chief Ombud has highlighted some of the issues relating to our Audit Remedial Action Plan. In the main, it's us still remaining with a qualified audit, but we're looking forward to changing that to maybe get to the next level of the AGB, the unqualified audit, with some of the findings. As you know, some of these issues take a bit of time more than what it would in a financial year to address. So with regards to the number of findings that we have in our management letter and the detailed findings, we have completed 13 of them, 9 which are still in progress, and 14 not yet started. And in the main, the reason for those not being started is because they are dependent on the closing off of the financial year. So the matters affecting the audit report, it would be the revenue discrepancies on our receivables. The technical opinion that the Chief Ombud has touched on is something that is in progress. It would be part of those that are in yellow that we are finalizing, and we have canvassed with audit opinion with the AG in terms of understanding, because these issues that are created by the legislative gap or interpretation then feed into how we report in terms of graph 23 with regards to the levies that we collect and the revenue. So that technical opinion, we're hoping we'll be able to canvass with National Treasury as well, so that we are able to deal with the issues affecting the audit report, which in the main are the reasons for our qualification. Irregular factors and expenditure as well as consequence management, I'll touch on when we get into the detail of the issue. But risk management disclosure notes and commitment disclosure notes, these were addressed as we were doing the audit. Some admin matters which are non-compliance, charters not reviewed, policies and procedures, as well as board charters not reviewed, are amongst those that we have addressed in the Audit Remedial Action Plan. So when we look at the detail of our first finding, which is the discrepancies on revenue and receivables, some of the action plans that we've committed to do include the SAGE billing module, where we are now billing all these schemes that have been paying the CISOs. So that program has gone live, and because of its ongoing nature, that's why it's classified as yellow, as ongoing and in progress. We did start the billing of schemes. They are receiving their invoices now together with the statements. The technical opinion in the main is what is currently in progress. We do have the draft. We are finalizing the final audit opinion, which we will canvass and hope to deal with the technical elements of how we account for the revenue. And we are hoping that what in essence would happen is that the completeness of our database and what we are filling is what is considered to be interpreted, what is within the control of the CISOs. So accounting policies are under review, and part of the implementation plans we had to do was to amend the CISOs 1 form, which has been amended, and all those are in check in order to try and address this issue of revenue and receivables. With regards to those notes that I've touched on earlier, risk management notes, fruitless and wasteful expenditure disclosure notes, those were appropriately addressed during the quarters, and they are done as and when the quarters are finalized to look into the financial statements disclosure. So under consequence management, the Chief Ombud has already touched on the issues of loss control. We have convened committees throughout the year in July as well as October. And there are reports that are serving in our governance structures regarding this consequence management. And in the past, with the CISOs, the culture was not to implement consequence management, but that has since changed and we are doing those processes. And in addition to enhance this process of consequence management, we have appointed new independent members to be part of the committee. This is just to ensure that the recommendations of the committee are then implemented, as some of the officials that will be sitting in the committee may be conflicted at some point in time, especially when we look at the root causes of fruitless and irregular expenditure root causes. I'll just high level jump on these. These were just relating to how we do our checklist in reviewing the accuracy of the financial statements. And in the main, it had to do with intangible assets, and we have done that, and we are continuously doing that, and we are reviewing our commitments listings for the quarters and for year end. The non-compliance with the BEE Act and register and related legislation, this was something that was new. I think most of the entities in public sector have received this kind of a finding. We were not participating in assessing ourselves whether we are BEE compliant. So this one has been done. We have received our BEE compliance certificate in terms of where we stand in the BEE Act. So this will be continuous going forward. So we've addressed the root cause, and we'll be having annual audits. And we've secured that the audits take place in the next 3 years. The charters, they have been reviewed and they've served on the board. So we've dealt with those findings so that everything is up to date. These are the ones that are time sensitive. So findings like related party disclosure notes, the recommendation is that we make use of the National Treasury Graph Checklist, and those are for all those outstanding notes in the financial statements. These we will only be able to then confirm as done by the 31st of March when we produce the latest set of financial statements. One of the issues affecting the audit report, which was consequence management, fruitless waste expenditure, and irregular, as highlighted earlier on, these are being processed through our loss control committee, and we are making sure that we take note and we take action on all those that which require action and recommend for condonement of some of this expenditure where the process has been done and fully compliant and warranted write-off of some of these expenditures is warranted. So on the overall recommendations on our remedial audit action plan, we've touched on the action plan itself and the timelines that we are monitoring, which we've included as part of our plan. In the earlier plan we had in the previous year was to ask National Treasury to report on a modified cash basis. This was obviously declined, and the alternative plan that we have was now looking at the technical opinion of recording our revenue in line with Graph 23, and that is what we are pursuing at the moment. As a revenue collection drive, the Chief Ombud has touched on that we are aggressive in our strategy to ensure that we are known, community schemes are aware that they need to register, and also are aware of their obligation to pay their CSOS levies. And also in the main to deal with issues of performance information, which are findings that we normally address in the audit, and we subsequently don't have matters going to the management report. We do have monthly reporting progress meetings as EXCO, as well as quarterly meetings, so that we can monitor and do corrective measures for performance information timelessly during the quarter as and when they occur. So Chair, Honourable Chair and Honourable Deputy Minister, I'll pause here with regards to the presentation on the detail and hand over back to the Chief Ombud. Thank you.
Chair, I'm not quite sure whether we will allow us to go ahead with the second presentation, or we're going to wait until you ask questions from the first presentation. I will hear from you, Chair.
Let's go into the second presentation as we have adopted the agenda that will receive both presentations. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chair. The next presentation is the National Housing Finance Corporation, which is NHFC, is in the process of procuring an exercise resource planning system to manage day-to-day business activities such as accounting, procurement, supply chain operations, risk management, and compliance. This system will align and improve processes leading to better monitoring and accountability as long-term response to the AG's concern. And I was listening to AG at the time that they were presenting. I think some of the issues that are going to raise are talking to AG's report. In addition to this, the NHFC is in the process of sourcing talent
to fill critical vacancies, and this came in the auditor's report, with the hope of completing the recruitment by the end of the current month, which is March 2022. And this was also raised, that filling of the vacancies are some of the issues that we're embarking on in not only these entities, in all entities. The meeting will also be pleased. I know that there was 57 million which was taken and now fraudulently, and now that money, they managed to recover it back. And I would want and also request the presenter to emphasize and also speak more on how they themselves managed to get the money back, and also how did they manage to steal the money, just those two, so that it's clear for the portfolio committee. And then the acting CEO, Mr. Gordon, will provide more details on how this happened. And I'm requesting Mr. Gordon to put more emphasis on this. Let me allow, Chair, without wasting time, Mr. Gordon to do the presentation. Thank you very much. Are you here, Mr. Gordon? The acting CEO? I don't know what's happening now. Division Longo? Do you have Mr. Gordon?
I'm checking on him, DM.
Maybe he has a problem of network. I don't know. He should be here. Is he alone, Division Longo?
He should be with the acting CFO.
Can we ask the acting CFO to come in the meantime? Maybe he will do the remarks after the presentation. Thank you. That's to save time.
Are you locked down in the portfolio committee? Please, it's your turn. They're waiting for you. Okay, just start presenting. Thanks.
Can you present? We are waiting for you, please.
Thank you. Let me bring up the presentation. Could I ask that someone puts up the presentation, please? I see I can't.
Hello, Mr. Gordon. We are a co-host now. You can present.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, So apologies for coming in a bit late. Can everyone see the presentation?
Yes,
you can see.
Okay, this presentation, I'm not sure if my CFO has managed to join yet. If she has, she will take over after I've presented the opening statements. Otherwise, I will carry on with the presentation. The purpose of the presentation is to update the committee on the action taken around the findings of the Auditor General from last year's annual financial statements of the NHFC. The key issues that were raised by the Auditor General were, as you can see here, mainly around supply chain management, around irregular expenditure, around failure to pay invoices within 30 days of receipt. There were numerous challenges around the information technology, and then there was incorrect disclosure in the financial statement that we submitted for audit on the 31st of May last year. And then there was a lack of adequate reconciliations of our accounts and reviews of those reconciliations. On the supply chain management, Nombula, the acting CFO, will present this section. Thank you, Nombula.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce. Good morning to the chairperson and good morning to everyone present in the meeting. If we look at some of the major interventions that we have implemented so far as an organization, we've implemented the loss control committee, which was appointed last year in June 2021. And their main focus is to implement the irregular expenditure framework within the organization and also to monitor the irregular expenditure in the organization. The terms of reference for the loss control committee have been updated, and they have also been enhanced to include issues such as addressing and identifying the root causes of the irregular expenditure. And not only to focus on the findings. And they also make recommendations to the CFO, and they also make sure that they ensure that the CFO implements the recommendations that are made to her in order to prevent future irregular expenditures. And if we look at the supply chain unit, the unit, in order to capacitate it better, it has been restructured in order for it to be able to be more efficient and also to be compliant with current regulation. And then in terms of appointing a new supply chain manager, we are anticipating that the supply chain manager will be appointed within the end of this month. And then because of all the challenges that were being experienced by the department, the supply chain department, it did affect the morale of the department, but we are working on addressing those issues as the organization. And next slide, please. And also if we look at other interventions that have been put in place, the supply chain policy has been updated in order to accommodate issues that were identified in the findings. And also the delegation of authority has been amended in order to empower other employees to be able to do the procurement for their departments. And also the policy for the irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure has been updated in order to include the reporting requirements, which are going to be more frequent, and also to accommodate how the company, when it experiences irregular expenditure, how it will do the collections for collections or recovery of those. And then there's also we've also implemented the contract management system. It has been put in place. It went live now in January in 2022. And the system is going to be used to monitor all active contracts, including sending out notification when contracts are nearing their end, so that the procurement of new contracts can be done in time. Next slide, please. And then the other issue that was raised during the audit was the payment of suppliers within 30 days. If you look at what is currently happening within the organization, you'll see that for some of the programs, we are able to pay, especially SMMEs who are in this program, we are able to pay them within 14 days. If you look at our age analysis for the creditors, you'll also see that majority of them are not older than 30 days, but we do still experience occasional invoices that are presented late, and majority of these relate to old legal matters that are being attended to. But we have put in place processes to improve that as well. And those processes will come in place beginning of next month, being the 1st of April. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, if we look at the information technology findings that were raised, just to give some background, when the entities merged, all the entities in a way, the NHSC inherited a lot of outdated and old systems, and in order to address that, the IT executive was recruited in 2019. In order to be able to implement an improvement plan for the IT environment, which also included developing a multi-year IT strategy for the organization. As part of the improvement plan, in this current year that we are in, an enterprise architecture program was undertaken in order to assess what processes are required and was concluded in late last year. And the outcome of that process was then used to issue out the ERP tender this year in January 2022. And the ERP system will then replace all the outdated systems that were inherited when the three entities merged. The ERP system, it is anticipated that the award for the new system for the tender will be done by end of April. And also because of the nature of IT projects or IT systems, it is anticipated that the system will take around 18 months to implement. Okay, we can go to the next slide. And then if we look at the IT security, if we look at issues that were raised around there, in the current financial year, two disaster recovery tests were conducted, and both of those tests were successful. And then also if one looks at the issues that were raised around the physical and the environmental control issues as it related to our server rooms, we can report that to say that most of the data for the organization is now stored in the cloud as part of also rolling the IT strategy. And the work of improving our IT security and our IT environment is ongoing and it is continuing. Thank you. Okay, next slide. Okay, if we look at the matters that were raised in the around the accounting and the financial statements, the entire finance team is being trained on GRAP in order to make sure that the entire team is up to date with the GRAP reporting standards in preparation for this upcoming financial year. And also what will happen is that before the financial statements are submitted to the AG on the 31st of May, they will be adequately and properly reviewed before they are submitted. And also what has happened this year, in order to make sure that the audit is also completed within the allocated time, we've had engagements with the AG and the audit has actually started. The audit for this year has actually started. Next slide, please. And then on the reconciliation and the filing side of things, the reviews of the reconciliation, what would happen is that this, the February month will be used to ensure that all reconciliations are properly evidenced and also all the identified reconciling items are cleared in preparation for the end of the financial year. And also in preparation for the audit, to make sure that at least by the time we do March, everything is as it should be. And also in terms of electronic filing, the process of implementing that, it is underway and it is anticipated that the electronic filing system will be in place within the 12 months in the organization. Thank you. Next one. Next slide. Okay, I hand back to you, Bruce. Thank you.
Yeah, I think what we've also looked at is what are the key risks we're facing in the current year. We have, during the year, we've been keep monitoring our irregular expenditure, particularly through the loss control committee and the procurement team. And we have found there has been some irregular expenditure, unfortunately, but we have identified it up front and we're taking action there. One of the comments from the Auditor General last year was that they found most of the irregular expenditure. And to prevent irregular expenditure, really, you have to find it yourself before the AG arrives. Otherwise, you're working in arrears instead of working progressively forward to ensure that action is taken. So we are working at that. Another issue that came up is 57 million rand was transferred out of our APSA money market account illegally in September last year. The Hawks are involved in investigating that. APSA has paid the money back to us, including as well as all the interest that there was due to us in terms of the contract we have with them, so that we are not out of pocket at all. And we are working with the Hawks to assist with finding who actually did it. We've submitted affidavits from our side on that. And in terms of internal, we found no internal processes that went wrong that led to this. So there's been no need for action internally against any employees. And we've got the money back, which I think is one of the things that we are thrilled about, but with our zero tolerance of frauds, and we actually are working very closely with the Hawks and helping APSA with finding out who the people were that were responsible. Our IT system enhancements, you'll have seen we are enhancing the system, so the auditors will undoubtedly find that some of the systems aren't working as well as they should yet, but we are working towards ensuring that. It's just the nature of IT that we can't have everything done immediately, but we have got a big project going to do that, and the IT executive is working very hard at ensuring that these systems and processes are well done and working well. I'd like to recommend that the portfolio committee note this progress, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
DDG.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me indicate that the AG action plan is being monitored by the department through the risk management forum that is held with all the entities, and also the CEO's forum that is chaired by the Director General. And lastly, let me also elevate the issue of filling of the critical positions, in particular these two entities. With the CISOs, we do have the Chief Ombud and the CFO, and we are covered at those levels. And with the NHSC, we are concluding the appointment of the board by this month, end of March. And the first responsibility of that new board will be to appoint the CEO, because CEO's position is vacant. And Mr. Gordhan will then go back to his position as the CFO. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Let me allow members to interact with the presentation. I don't see any hands. Members, are we satisfied with the presentation?
That is a good chair. If there are no hands.
We have Honorable Powell, we have Honorable Mokgotho, we have Honorable Sufai, in that order.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've got about 14 questions for the CSOS. So if you will just indulge me, I may take 10 or so minutes. I know we've got about an hour and 50 left, so we're not sort of pressed for time. So I'd like to welcome the presentation from the CSOS and from the NHBRC. My questions are specifically for CSOS because I think that there are a number of issues that are becoming increasingly concerning in terms of this entity. We're seeing a lot of noise mounting in the public space, and I certainly am receiving quite an increasing number of queries and complaints. So I'd like to just take this opportunity while we've got Advocate Nkies with us to put some questions to him that he can answer before this committee. And I'd also just like to, at this point, welcome that a lot of the concerns that have been raised with me are in respect of delays. And I can see from the presentation and from what Advocate Nkies says that there'll be a tracking system that's put in place. So if we can just, as a committee, finally welcome that, because I think that that's long overdue, this tracking system for disputes being implemented. But in terms of this audit plan and in terms of things that are being escalated, certainly to my office, I'm quite deeply concerned about internal controls, risk management, BE compliance, all the issues that are raised in this report itself. So I'm going to put 14 questions to Advocate Nkies, if he can please take note, and I will be happy to also send these in writing. If he misses out and is, we can then follow up. I'll put them in the chat box in writing. So firstly, in terms of Section 36 of the CSOS Act, the Chief Ombud must issue practice directives with regards to matters pertaining to the operation of the service. And these practice directives must be subject to the Act and the regulations, and they obviously direct the performance of the Act in its operation. Allegations have been put to my office in a number of complaints from individuals and agencies that CSOS are using practice directives signed by the board to in fact amend or further extend the CSOS Act and the Sectional Title Schemes Management Act, which is obviously clearly not in their mandate. So can Advocate Nkies give us a response as to how CSOS interprets the Act to allow for the extension of these two pieces of legislation by means of practice directives? And I'm happy to provide examples. Question two, CSOS are supposed to operate within very strict timeframes, and in reality, we see that matters are dragging on for years, which is why we welcome this new tracking system. But there are also a number of procedural flaws and delays that can't be excused. Can Advocate Nkies please tell this committee why the CSOS are not sticking to the timelines that they've been set, and when delays occur, why they are not dealt with or explained? I, Advocate Nkies and Kanozi, will see that I'm often CC'd into emails. Some of these are responded to very timely, others are outstanding for months. I see just this morning a complaint that's been outstanding for months has been responded to while we've been in this meeting. Can we just have an explanation around the delays? Then CSOS have put together a list of BE compliant trained executive management agencies, the EMAs, and the entity now appears to be compelling owners and trustees to appoint this EMA. So for example, there's only one that's been identified in the Western Cape. So there's actually no choice in terms of the appointment of executive management agencies. And other than two names on the list that's been provided, there's no listed company that's actually known to industry players. And the CSOS have further promoted the appointment of this EMA by a trustee resolution, even though the Sectional Title Schemes Management Act provides that a special resolution of members is required. Under what authority are the CSOS accrediting EMAs? Can we just have a justification as to why there's been only one EMA identified in the Western Cape, and the authority, the specific legislative authority that CSOS are relying on to accredit these EMAs? Then what is, this is a big area of concern. concern, of recent concern. There's a huge amount of hype about it, certainly on social media. Advocate McKees, I know that your inbox and your Adjudicator General's inbox are being flooded in terms of these queries, and that's got to do with the new Poppy Act, so the Protection of Personal Information Act. Can the advocate please let the committee know what the entity's justification and support for their view that the Sexual Title Schemes Management Act and its regulations are now trumped by the new Puppy Act, noting that no legislation can, of course, vary another piece of legislation, in that records to which owners are entitled under the Sexual Title Schemes Management Act and its concomitant regulations are now being withheld or regulated in terms of adjudication orders, and this is done under the auspices of preventing against potential breaches of the Puppy Act. Does CSOS have a legal opinion on this that they are willing to share with this committee? Chairperson, for your noting, this is becoming a huge issue that we as a committee are going to have to deal with, this use of the Protection of Personal Information Act as an excuse to withhold information, notwithstanding exemptions contained in Puppy itself and specifications in legislation that has already been passed and promulgated and enacted. Question five, adjudication orders were only capable of being taken on appeal if there was an error in law, yet there appears to be little or no consistency in matters, and procedural flaws are extensive in terms of matters being directed to my office. You'll note what often as MPs copied into these emails. When will the CSOS introduce an internal review process? Because at the moment, people have to go to the High Court. And that's obviously laborious and expensive, and, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. People are really upset. We've had protest marches, as many of you are aware, and our inboxes are all flooded with streams of angry recipients. Adjudication recipients. Question six, there are countless examples where the STSMA is correctly interpreted and applied by CSOS with very little motivation for their decision, and in many instances the adjudication orders are plainly in contravention of the Sexual Title Schemes Management Act. Practice directives are not shared with the public before being signed by the board, and there are sometimes they're poorly worded and unclear. In levy collection matters, the CSOS have not been allowing interest to be raised on outstanding accounts that have been ordered to pay, even though the Sexual Title Schemes Management Act allows for the same. Advocate, how does the CSOS justify applying the law in terms of their own discretion, and then individuals have to approach the High Court on the basis of an error in law? And what does CSOS intend to do to make sure that individuals have got some kind of a recourse? And that then leads me to my next two questions. There's been a lot of talk by senior officials within this entity on sort of at events and recorded podcasts and the like, where it's alluded that there is an imminent amendment in the pipeline to both the STSMA and the CSOS Act. Now, we as a committee, certainly, we are not aware that that these amendments are in the pipeline. Certainly, they are not on our legislative program. I make sure that from time to time, I submit parliamentary questions to the minister in terms of the legislative agenda, any legislation that's before cabinet for noting or approval, or before the department. We've got the Housing Consumer Protection Act before this committee, that's before parliament now, but certainly no STSMA or CSOS amendments. But the public and industry stakeholders are being told that there are imminent amendments. Can Advocate McKees please clarify before Parliament today, A, are there currently planned amendments to either the STSMA or the CSOS Act? And if so, what are these planned amendments that this committee certainly has no knowledge of? Has there been any public participation in respect of any of these planned amendments? We're certainly not aware of that. And I think that this is necessary so that we can start clearing up with stakeholders when senior officials from CSOS inform the public and senior stakeholders that these amendments are in play. I think it's really important that we, this committee, is informed of that. Nearly finished, Chairperson. has the CSOS got any mandate to replace the current court system as a forum for collections of arrear levies from an institution of dispute to sale in the execution of a movable property? Third to last question, no advisory committees have been set up by the board, certainly to my knowledge, in terms of Section 12 of the CSOS Act, and this is notwithstanding that the entity has been operational for more than 5 years. And again, I have submitted a question to the minister on this. It should be submitted to her office in the next week or so. But to my knowledge, I know that there has been an overhaul of the boards, but to my knowledge, there are no current board members that have demonstrable sectional title and homeowner association expertise, which is creating a danger that the regulator doesn't actually even understand the industry that it functions. I know that Minister Gabayi has gone to great lengths across all entities of this department since she's taken over to right-size these boards that we know were just places where CADAs had previously been placed. And I understand that there were adverts that went out in newspapers to try and address these issues that we'd been raising. But when does the CSOS anticipate appointing committees, advisory committees, that will actually assist the board in performing its functions, notwithstanding the fact that to our knowledge there is very little expertise on that board? Second to last question, has the CSOS received a mandate to utilize funds paid by homeowners in respect of the setting up of businesses for previously disadvantaged persons? And if so, where and what oversight will be implemented on the utilization of such funds? This is a very, if we could please understand the mandate, if it was a ministerial directive, but this new practice of utilizing funds paid by homeowners for purposes of BEE. And then last question, how are the CSOS justifying the turnover of adjudicators and the appointment of adjudicators that clearly have no relevant expertise or knowledge? Those are my chairpersons. I'd like for them to be answered by the advocate in this meeting, chairperson. If he is unclear or has missed a question, I'm happy to place them in the chat box. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Powell, Honorable Mokgotho.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is directed to NHFC. I would like to know, NHFC stated that invoices are now paid on time, but there are instances where some of the invoices are paid after 30 days due to invoices received by them after 30 days. So I would like to know which processes have you put in place to address this challenge? And then another question is that you said recruitment of supply chain management posts will probably be done by the end of the month, of which you are just guessing, you are not even sure. And then again, in the absence of the permanently appointed CEO and supply chain management, how are you going to curb the risk of not following the correct supply chain management processes when awarding a tender to service providers? Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mokgotho, Honorable Sekgal.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and the department and our visitors, NHC and Cisco's and the AG, if still here. Chair, it's important to firstly appreciate the recovery plan that has been made by CSOS. As we know the history, and we know how CSOS has been struggling to get to the grips of the program. I think it's important to make that appreciation. The issues that I think I have managed to get is the appointment of the new board. I think that is a plus. And also the establishment of the loss control body, which is going to assist them. But two areas that I think perhaps the CISO should strengthen again is its program. I like the view that says they are to make sure that they have a quality profile as CISOs, because within the market forces, you must have a very clear, strong identity for your consideration and also for your participation. I think that's very important. The presenter raised an issue that in the process of registration, what lacked is an enforcement mechanism. We wish that perhaps in another meeting you will tell us how are you going to deal with this enforcement, because it's important, very, very important. The other issue is the issue of a comment, Chair, that says, CISO should understand its program. It's a very unique, transformative program to redress. And we perhaps the patience that we had in terms of improving CISOs was informed of that particular process. Because the poor people, historically, were not given any opportunity to participate in schemes like this. Because they are not payable. They are not bankable. But I think CISO's program is very transformative, and we should even acknowledge the fact that that's why there are these problems. But the way that we are trying to address the issues is really very appreciative. And your program is very unique. And that uniqueness necessitate the management, the ombudsman to have networks. These programs have been there in the country, even in the continent. So you need to have networks on how did other countries put programs of this nature, and how did they intervene in the areas of their weaknesses. What is a strong ombudsman, Mr. Ombudsman, is the how to establish systems that speak to other systems. Systems that speak to other systems internally, so that your program is very strong. It's not fragmented. Not fragmented. So those are the areas I want to raise on CISOs. In NHSC, NHFC, I want to raise the issue on the 30 days. This 30 days has been a talk, even in this department, for years, ever since we came here. Can we get a presentation, Chair, of a sequential procedure? First day, second day, third day, until 30 days. Now that the NHC is saying that they are winning the war of the 30 days, what is it? What are they putting in place as an evidence? So that also ourselves, we are comfortable about them achieving this objective of paying SMEs or business people within 30 days. Because the issue is, this is not just one of those. It's improving the economy of the country and improving the individuals to perform better. See, one of the issues that NHS has raised is that there are late submissions even by the business partners, which then necessitate that NFC should have a program even to educate them. Remember, government is government for all. Because they're business school doesn't mean they know all. So it's important that there should be a program to engage them and educate them how must they make their business so that we have a better quality business. The last one is the issue of the stolen money. This is a mystery because I hear that the money is not stolen from inside. Maybe I didn't get that right. It's not an internal issue. It's something that is not known. Can we get a report on the matter? You see, because as it is now, it's creating anxiety on us to know the curiosity. Where was this money stolen from? But besides that report, which we need, please strengthen your systems. You see, if your systems are not speaking, whoever who's presenting a program to whoever must be able to be monitored by other systems. Systems must speak together so that you're able to see that somebody is stealing our money. How does it happen this money is stolen? It cannot be stolen over a day. There has been a process trying to steal. It's a lot of money. So your systems are still not strong, NFC. Try to strengthen your system so that you are able to see everything. Even something is not well in the department. The programs are being challenged by whatever. Your systems are going to tell you. That's my proposal, Chair, that strengthen your systems. Let's get a report of how the money get lost, and then we address the matter. Thank you, Chair. Where's the
chair? Thank you, Honorable Sakai. Honorable Chafen, I'm not sure whether you are back. You have raised your hand and you got lost. I'm not sure if you're not work or what. Honorable Mokoto. Honorable Tafeni raised the hands and she has disappeared. Because we are not getting response from Honorable Tafeni. Let me congratulate both CISOS and NHFC for their action plan in responding to the outcome of the Auditor General's report. Just to acknowledge that you have actually adhered to the call of the committee for you to deal with the root causes of the findings. We hope that we'll not have the repeated finding in the next audit report, because you are saying, both of you, you are saying you are dealing with the root cause. I will be surprised and shocked if we have any repeated findings. After the Auditor General's report, we hope we can rely on you that indeed you are addressing the root causes. But just to check in terms of the processes and the systems that you have, as you are saying, you're strengthening, particularly with CISOS, strengthening your systems, policy, improving your systems and policy processes, and trying to strengthen your legislation. One, whether are we winning in that regard, in terms of that, because if we just saying we're improving the policies, improving the systems, and but we are not actually winning, it's something else. Because one of the things that we have observed, which makes the repeated findings, that you'd say we are improving the policies, we're improving our systems, but you still get the repeated findings. We want to assurance from yourself that indeed the trajectory that you are following, we're not going to see the we're going to see the improved accountability and compliance in terms of the law of this country. The second issue is on the wrong investment. I think it will be very helpful because, you know, the issue of the VBS is a worrisome issue in the country. It should not be hidden within wrong investment. We must talk about it and we must appreciate what is it that we're doing as CISOs to get that money back and what happened to those people who have wrongly invested on the VBS. One of the things that comes out very sharply in terms of the departments in general is the legal cost of us trying to implement or comply. At some point, we would want to come back to this issue that how much are we spending in the legal battles that we have as entities and the department in terms of trying to implement the program of government. I want to add on the NHFC on the stolen money that would want a proper report which tell us what happened. Why the money skip up out of the system of government when there is people supposed to monitor it and at some point we need to be told in your investigation what happened so that you can then promise these committees that such things would not happen again. And if it's a legislation or something that needs to be done to make sure that there should not be such situation in the near future, we would need that. I think it's very much important on that. And then we welcome that. I can see that you have set the supply chain manager has been dismissed. For you to correct the issues that were raised by Auditor General as part of your consequence management on the SCM. Does that mean that you do not have the findings for because consequence management is something is appreciated, but the correcting of the system such does not open the loopholes for anybody to do that, to repeat the same mistakes. It's critical and important. Going back to the issues of the root causes of what the finding was, because we want to see the information that is given to Auditor General
at some point would not have such findings in the near future. So I'll welcome, if Honorable Tafeni is not yet back, I'll welcome you to respond on the issues.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I will start with Advocate Mkize, because the questions are directed to them. Then after that, I will allow the NHFC to respond. Thank you very much. We'll start with you, CEO Mkize. Then at the end, I will allow all outreaches that would want to say something.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister, Honorable Chair of the Committee, Honorable Members, and thank you for the questions that have been raised. Quite an extensive list there from Honorable Power. We'll try and weed through them quite swiftly. Perhaps just as a preface, I think it's important to register that the CISOs has generally poorly performed in the past, has had a checkered history in terms of the record of service delivery, responsiveness, efficiency. That is an issue that we really cannot run away from. That's the unfortunate past. We are working quite tirelessly to reverse the order of things. In this regard, we have launched a service charter, which is our pledge and commitment to the public, to basically say we're here for the public, and we're here to actually assure them of the efficiencies that we want to build in into the system. As we do this, we are also attending to the issue of capacitating the organization, which has essentially been run on the basis of interns and temporary staff. For the longest time, with a structure that was not completely aligned to the strategy of the organization. So these are historical realities. I can share with the committee, honorable committee members, that we have already started seeing fruits of the tireless efforts that we have put as the CISOs, starting from just the issues of performance, which have risen to above 80% from the previous below 50% type of performance levels, etc. So we are seeing things turning around in terms of that. But also, I just need to indicate that the issue of service delivery and complaints from the public, in the nature of things, the nature of the organization, are such that you may not necessarily satisfy everyone that is out there. I think that should be accepted as a fact. And sometimes people complain, not so much because of the inefficiencies, but simply because there's been an adverse finding against them when they had hoped for a positive finding. So we need to understand that there are situations like those, and these will play themselves out in social media, platforms and other areas, not suggesting a failure in the systems of the CISOs per se, but simply, you know, just a reflection of the frustrations of those perhaps that may have been the recipients of adverse findings by the CISOs. So I needed to contextualize that just as a preface. So having said that, then dealing with a few items, in terms of Section 36, there was issue around the practice directives. I agree that the practice directives cannot in and of themselves create a separate legal mandate for the CISOs. They obviously need to derive from the provisions of the Act. We are not aware of any practice directive that is actually inconsistent with the provisions of the Act. We'll be happy to engage in a conversation in terms of practical examples in this regard. And we are happy to engage the member in relation to those issues. But in terms of the practice directives that we've issued, we have been careful to maintain these within the confines of the legislative mandate that the CISOs enjoys, and to ensure that these are in fact harmonized with it. These are meant to actually enhance our practices and the experience of our stakeholders, so that we are in fact able to explain and articulate our processes even better for people to understand these issues. The issue of the matters that are dragging for years, why is CISO not sticking to the timelines? As I've indicated, these are turning. We have cleared the backlog of the matters, which is another accolade in terms of the tireless efforts we've put into this. We are now trying to push for matters that are current so that these are finalized within the period of 90 days. But not only have we done that, this is now in terms of the adjudication processes. We are instituting a process where at every stage of our process, the complainant or the applicant or the respondents would actually be advised of where the progress of their matter is. This is to ensure that the people are actually kept abreast. I've instituted a system whereby inquiries are responded to on a first come, first served basis and on an immediate basis without procrastination in this regard. So we're beginning to see quite a good turn in relation to those issues. So the delays essentially were as a result of the backlog in the past. We've cleared this. We are now trying to make sure that some of the processes are fast-tracked in such a way that, in fact, some of the matters have now been actually concluded in a space of within 30 days, as opposed to the 90-day target, which we have as part of our service standards, given the complexity of the legislative environment. So there is improvement there. Executive management agents, black managing executive managing agents, it is incorrect to suggest that any scheme has been compelled to engage the executive black managing agents. I'm going to address this question, Honourable Member Powell, together with the question that you raised around the issue of the mandate and the process. So in terms of our mandate with regards to this issue, Section 5 of the Community Schemes Act basically provides that the minister must conclude a written mandate with the CISOs, and that mandate must, amongst other things, contain directions regarding the utilization of any surplus revenue, contain specific delivery targets that the service must attain, and contain operation and performance indicators that the service will be measured against. Having said that, I think it's important to also note that the Section 5, which I've just alluded to above, is actually synchronized with the Department of Human Settlements strategic mandate and the annual performance plan of the department. In particular, page 24 of the DHS annual performance plan identifies inverted commas, open inverted commas, transformation of property sector and increased participation of designated groups, close inverted commas, as one of its priorities. So this is a strategic mandate, and that's not only flowing from the Department of Human Settlements, but also it is a government-wide and nationwide concern in terms of addressing the triple tragedies that we are exposed to as a country of inequality and poverty and hunger. And furthermore, DHS in page 74 of its annual performance plan has got a performance target which says for the CISOs, community scheme sector value chain transformed. So we're talking about transformation here, so that's where we derive our mandate. I must also add that in terms of the mandate of the National Development Plan 2030, Chapter 8, it directs that planning in South Africa will be guided by a set of normative principles to create spaces that are livable, equitable, sustainable, resilient and efficient, and support economic opportunities and social cohesion. This is derived from page 17 of the CISO's annual performance plan. In terms of the medium-term priorities identified by the President in his State of the Nation address in 2019, page 18, referencing this particular State of the Nation address by the President, indicates that economic transformation and job creation will be one of those key priorities. In terms of item 6.1.1 of the CISOS outcomes, outputs, performance indicators, and targets, the CISOS targets to procure at least 70% of equivalent equivalent of its procurement spend on majority Black-owned entities. You'll find this in page 33 of the CISOS Annual Performance Plan 2021. These plans, by the way, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member Powell, have been shared widely with this very committee, and they have been approved as marching orders for the CISOs to create a particular mandate around the issue of transformation of the community schemes. The initiative of the executive Black Managing Agents is meant to do nothing but to advance the socio-economic transformation objectives that we all uphold as this government and as the officials of this government. It is incumbent upon us to address the social ills and the economic ills and the lack of opportunity and the aspects that have been created by the system in the past that prevented others from participating fully and meaningfully in the economy of this country. We have been transparent about this. We have not hidden anything, and the process through which these agents were appointed was a national process where we actually advertised in the public space for emerging managing agents that are drawn from historically disadvantaged communities to participate in the panel. We accredit those because they've gone through a particular selection process so that they are on our panel. We have advertised their existence to all schemes, to all and sundry, to basically say, you've got these entities. They are drawn from historically disadvantaged communities. They've gone through a process, transparent process, and everybody has had an opportunity to actually respond to this. And that's why the issue of there being one entity in the Western Cape is not an issue of the CISOs doing. It is an issue of entities not being in a position to respond or not having responded. And we have no control over that. It's like advertising a bid and no one responds to that bid. It can't be, you know, alluded to us as an issue of the failure in the process. So it's important for us to understand that no one is compelled, no one is forced to actually appoint any of these people on the panel, but those corporate citizens that are committed to transformation of our society and economy will actually grab this opportunity with both hands to actually advance the cause of socioeconomic transformation. And nobody is forced to do that. By the way, I must also add that in the past 2 weeks, I have personally been meeting with the CEOs of the big entities, managing agents, your Pretos, your Trafalgars, your mid-cities, et cetera, and the crusade that I've embarked upon to engage with them was to basically say, yes, we've advertised the Black executive managing agents as a panel, but we are not throwing the baby with the bathwater. What we want to look at is twinning programs where you can equally participate in the advancement of the transformation agenda of this country and ensuring that the Black executive managing agents are in fact capacitated, they are supported, that they work together with you, that they're exposed to your system, they're exposed to your infrastructure, and we are able to actually support them in a way that becomes sustainable and that also becomes true to the socioeconomic goals of this government. So we have indicated clearly that there is space for the big entities to participate, but they are not participating as panel members in this instance because they are not emerging. They are not historically disadvantaged. disadvantaged. They've always had opportunities. They manage schemes in hundreds, in thousands. They manage budgets that, in fact, exceed billions of rands. So we're saying, as part of their plow back to the community, and in fact, I must say and report to this portfolio committee, I've been warmly received by those CEOs of the big industries, of the big entities in this regard, and who see a genuine opportunity to contribute towards socioeconomic advancement. So it is incorrect to suggest that the EMAs that have been appointed and accredited onto our panel are being forced down the throats of schemes. We can't do that. It is the responsibility of the schemes themselves to make that call. We don't direct the AGMs. We don't direct the resolutions in terms of who they appoint and how they appoint them. All we're interested in is that there must be good governance. And those principles have been set in terms of how the schemes ought to be managed in relation to that. Now, there is a question about POPI, the POPI Act, and the documents that have not been shared. Well, I would love to see what sort of documents we're talking about here, and essentially how those have been accounted to the POPI Act. But it is reality that POPI Act is with us, and we need to observe the principles that are enshrined in the POPI Act. I do accept that there are exceptions, and the exceptions are clear in the Act, clearly articulated. Now, obviously, if the documents that are not being shared fall within the ambit and the parameters of the exceptions, well, clearly there is no cause for the CISOs to withhold those documents, and they can share those documents. But if there are issues that fall outside of the exceptions, we certainly would not violate the provisions of an Act of Parliament, would be undermining the very essence of the rule of law of this country. So we will not do that as the CISOs, but where it can be demonstrated that the documents required do not offend the principles of POPI, by all means, we are happy to share those. So if there are any specific issues in that area, we'll be happy to indicate. Now, obviously, you would be aware, Honourable Member Powell, that in the instance where we are dealing with personal information, if it is not for purposes of pursuing a particular investigation in terms of the law, this is part of the exceptions recognized in POPI, we would actually not be in a position to share information that pertain to personal information pertaining to an applicant or a respondent in a particular dispute before us. But obviously, we would have to look into each case on its own merit, and we'll be happy to engage if there are any specifics in this regard. There is an issue around adjudication orders on appeal versus an internal process. Are we planning to introduce an internal review process? This is a subject of legal principles. Legal principles in the sense that there are pros and cons to this. You can create an internal review mechanism, I suppose, to some degree, but perhaps to deal with such things as administrative errors. But when it comes to the essence of the legal principles, Member Powell perhaps may be aware that there is two principles that I think are relevant here. One is the principle of functus officio. That principle simply means that once you have been seized with the matter and you've made a decision, you've ceased function. In terms of that matter, and therefore you can no longer pronounce yourself on that issue. So that's the first principle. That principle is supported by yet another Stone Age legal principle, which is that you cannot be a judge in your own cause. So you've made a judgment on the matter, you can't then sit in judgment of the same matter. So those are the legal principles that perhaps might work against an internal review mechanism. But we understand the point that is being raised. Ours is a quasi-judicial system that we follow. And because of that, it's got certain legal ramifications, and part of which might be to actually look into what the courts, in fact, deal with in this regard. But we are looking into a system where we can correct administrative errors and things where there is, in fact, just such an erroneous administrative issues in the adjudication orders. And in due course, we will basically deal with that. I note that there is a concern that the STSMA, which is the Sectional Titles Management Act, might be interpreted incorrectly in certain instances by the adjudication orders or by the adjudicators. This will, of course, be the subject of the court's determination on appeal when they either confirm the adjudication order or set it aside. Interpretation and misinterpretation happens on a daily basis in courts and all over. And sometimes the higher courts arrive at different decisions than the lower courts. It doesn't suggest anything untoward. It can only be an issue of interpretation. So we do accept that in certain instances, there may be instances where the adjudication order does not correctly interpret the law, in which case then the remedy is to actually have it set aside through a process of an appeal. Now, the practice directives being shared with the public prior to issue, we don't have a practice of doing that and sharing the practice directives prior to them being issued. These are meant to actually guide the schemes, the stakeholders out there. But the practice we've instituted now is to actually engage with industry associations so that they are aware, and we have quarterly briefings and quarterly meetings with them where we actually share developments in our regulatory environment. And we've found that it is actually quite helpful. And we have, in fact, received inputs, very constructive inputs in this regard. Talks about imminent amendments to CSIS Act and the Sectional Title Schemes Management Act. There's nothing secret or hidden about that. Our Act is grossly inadequate. The Sectional Titles Management Act is also grossly inadequate. There are inconsistencies in certain respects. So the legislative framework is inadequate, and we are not happy with the current legal framework. So we're working to actually amend or seek adjustments to the current legislative framework. Member Powell will be aware that we do not have authority to actually change any act. But before and this particular structure here going into Parliament via the executive authority, which is our minister, would actually be the ones that drive that particular process. But the process does not start in Parliament. It doesn't start with the portfolio committee. Neither does it start with the executive authority. It starts at a conceptual level where we look into the policy issues. We look into the practical implication issues of the current prevailing legislation and how those inhibit our ability to be efficient and effective in our legislative mandate. And so what then happens is that we start the conceptualization work. This is what we are busy with at the moment. We put up draft concepts. We take those draft concepts. We then engage with the department. In this regard, we're engaging with the legal unit of the department. We've also engaged with the Director General and the CEO's Forum and DDG Ngongo, who's responsible for these issues, to actually start socializing the idea possibly effecting adjustments to our legislative framework. In due time, these things will then come through to the relevant structures once they've been properly considered, once they've been properly processed, so that then the process of public engagement of Parliament Portfolio Committee and the relevant structures, then they can embark on that. So It can't be imminent, Member Powell, without going through those relevant structures. So it has to go through as a matter of course, and it will come in due course. We are working on this to ensure it's done. The amendments, of course, I want to respect the time of this committee, because essentially we were here to deal with the audit improvements remedial program. So I can't start a discussion now about the nature of the amendments that are being proposed. I think a separate discussion perhaps may be required to actually take the members through that. And with your leave, Chair, I would like to suggest that I don't address the nitty-gritties relating to the amendments just in respect of the time and the nature of this meeting, because this was not necessarily an item for this conversation today. But we are happy to share the direction, at least, that we seek to take with regards to the amendments. We do not have the authority to replace court action or court judgments when it comes to the issues of levies or payments or non-actions, etc. Obviously, we respect the court and respect the judgments. So the CISOS does not have the authority to alter a court judgment. That's a short answer to that question. The advisory committees, I'm not too certain what that refers to, but I know that in terms of the STSMA, there is a council that needs to be set up. That process is underway. We've already put documents up with the Office of the Director General, and this matter is being processed. I can't comment on the issue of the expertise on the qualifications of the members of the board relative to the issue of the sectional schemes or sectional titles experience, but all I can share with Member Powell, this decision obviously is taken by the executive authority, but all I can share with the Member Powell is that all the CISOS board members have got the necessary aptitude, qualifications, experience, good corporate governance, and I don't think that the executing authority made a mistake. We are receiving good counsel and guidance and oversight based on the expertise that those members hold. So I'm not sure what aspects of concern have arisen in this regard. Has the CISOS received a mandate to utilize funds by homeowners for BE? I've addressed this issue earlier on when I dealt with the issue of the mandate and the directives flowing from Section 5 of the Act, the SONA by President, and the pronouncements that we all know about the transformation imperatives of this country and of this government, and therefore what we are seeking to do is to actually deal with this aspect on the basis of the legislated framework. We, in fact, have even had engagements with National Treasury in this regard to actually discuss these issues. So the mandate is quite clear. We cannot operate as if everything is normal. The transformation of the community schemes sector, the property sector, is quite critical for sustainability of our nation, and it is important that we address ourselves to that. That mandate is quite clear, and there is no ambiguity about it. Even the annual performance plans of both DHS, the Department of Human Settlements, and our own annual performance plans speak to these issues. We are measured on the extent to which we are advancing transformation. It is an imperative that we cannot negotiate, unfortunately. And so we will have to proceed to go through with those issues. I'm not aware of any adjudicator that was appointed without experience. We've got set criteria for appointment of adjudicators. And these adjudicators are actually selected through quite a rigorous process. There might be complaints, perhaps, that we have appointed more adjudicators from historically disadvantaged communities. But they are not token appointments, Member Powell. They are worth their salt. These are people that are admitted as attorneys. These are people that are running their own practices. These are people that are advocates that have got the necessary aptitude, experience, and everything it takes for them to actually operate as adjudicators. And some even more qualified than those that we've had historically from areas that perhaps may not be historically disadvantaged. So it is perhaps not correct to suggest that we have appointed adjudicators without experience. Of course, if the question is these people have perhaps not been adjudicators of the CISOs before, well, that may be correct. Even those that are historically there, at some point, they had not been with the CISOs. And because of that, they were given the opportunity to actually apply their trade and to understand how the CISOs functions. There are bi-weekly training sessions with these adjudicators, all of them, by the way, to make sure that they are ingrained into the processes of the CISOs. Just like those ones that were not previously exposed to the issues of the CISOs, we've done the same to give others an opportunity. But we've obviously not thrown out anyone on account of them having been there in the past, as it were. Honorable Sishwai, I think the question around lack of enforcement mechanism is an issue that flows from the weaknesses in our legislation. And in due time, as I've indicated, we will present some proposed improvements to help us with the enforcement regime. For example, the issue I was raising earlier on is what do you do as the CISOs if there's a scheme that basically simply decides not to actually remit its levies to the CISOs? There is very little that is provided for in terms of the powers and consequences in legislation now to help us enforce that particular requirement. So that's the issue that we're dealing with, and it's a function of dealing with the regulations and or legislation. And I agree 100% on with the fact that the systems ought to be established that speak to each other. This is the reason we have embarked on a massive digitization program. It's called the Business Automation Solution. And we are already, at the end of this month, March, we'll be seeing two models being created that would enable online web-based registration by schemes. So people don't have to travel to the CISOs. They don't have to complete paper forms, et cetera, to do this. And these things can be done on an interactive web-based application. We are seeing also a module that's going to come out that has to do with customer relationship management and a few other modules that are going to come, you know, later in the year, including disputes management system that is going to address the issue. So the systems are, in fact, being created. The CFO spoke to the billing module that has come up as part of our ERP programs. This is to enable billing of the schemes and ensuring that the statements of account are issued, etc. That ERP package is going to include things like SCM and other support functions such as HR and related issues. Honorable Semenya, Chair, yes, you're correct indeed around the issue of improved policies. Perhaps that might be there and not necessarily registering wins. I suppose the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as always. And our view is that we are registering progress indeed beyond just the establishment of policy frameworks. There are tangible and practical victories that we are seeing, upon which, you know, these policies are embedded. With regards to the issue of the repeat findings, we are doing our best to deal with the issues of internal controls. Now, it gets very tricky when it comes to these issues of repeat findings. because we need to understand the context and the nature of the issues that have been raised and the extent to which those have a potential of replication based on things perhaps that may even be beyond our control. However, it is important for us to register that we're doing our very best to actually prevent, mitigate, minimize recurrence of these issues. Having institutionalized some quality assurance measures in place, even in terms of our procurement, our 30-day invoicing processes are quite on point at this stage as the CSOS. We are looking into those improvements. The consequence management issues are being implemented. Matter of fact, on that VBS matter, Honorable Chair, you asked about what happened to the people. Those people had their contracts terminated who were involved in this saga. But that's not the end of the story, because in terms of the VBS, we are in liaison constantly with the Hawks, who have assured us that there is now a draft report that has come out that basically will indicate the movement of the flow of funds. We are hoping that out of that report, once the Hawks become comfortable to share it with us, we'll be able to actually institute such mechanisms as potentially asset for future, if there are any assets that could be pursued or attached in this regard in order to satisfy the debt based on the flow of funds that perhaps may be identified in terms of those reports. We are waiting for the Hawks in this regard. Their processes grind a little bit slowly, and as a result, we have to always just wait on them. We have enlisted our interest as creditor with the VBS. Obviously, some of these things, as members may be aware, have become a shell where there's just no assets to actually recoup in relation to this. But we need to demonstrate to our Audit and Risk Committee that we've done everything in our power to actually, and of course to the board, to actually try and recover. And once those efforts have yielded fruit, then we will sing hallelujah. If they haven't, we may then be forced to get to a point where we seek condemnation for the write-off of that particular debt. At this stage, we're still trying to pursue engagement with the Hawks to make sure that we've done everything in our power to pursue those things. The consequence management processes, the CFO spoke to that at length, and so I don't need to repeat the fact that we are, in fact, we have, in fact, instituted certain actions to deal with non-compliance in relation to these issues. So, Honourable Chair, I would stop there. I think I've covered the questions. If I haven't addressed any question, members may duly point me to that. Thank you so much, Honourable Chair.
I think while we're still waiting for the chair, there's also another entity. Gordon, Mr. Gordon, you can come in and answer your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Deputy Minister. I think the questions, Honourable Makoto, you asked about the processes to address late payments. What we are doing there is we're setting up an email address, a centralized email address, where all invoices can be sent directly to the finance department, who will then have a register of when they are received and ensure that they chase them up from the relevant departments to make sure that they're paid within the 30 days. I find it annoying that we don't pay everyone on time, given that with the SMMEs, in the rental repair program that we're managing for the City of Cape Town, we have 130 SMMEs there. We guarantee payment within 14 days, and we manage to make most of those payments within 7 days. So how we cannot pay somebody within 30 days, I find quite unacceptable, and we're going to sort that out. The appointment of the SCM manager, I noticed Nomvula was a bit uncertain about the end of the month. It will happen at the end of the month, by the end of the month, that we will have an SCM manager in place. We have got very competent people internally who can be appointed. We don't need to go outside the organization and procure employment agencies or anything. We'll do an internal promotion because I firmly believe that internal is the best place to find people who are good for your organization. You asked about how, with everybody acting, we can ensure compliance. I think what you'll find is the people that in the organization and are acting are highly capable people. The acting supply chain manager has a degree in supply chain, so she's very capable there. She's very strict. Sometimes maybe people in the organization will complain that she's too strict, in fact. But I'm happy with that at the moment, and I think that is getting us great compliance on our particularly our tender processes. We are having some large tenders at the moment, as we spoke about, with the IT fix-up program that we've got coming. The 57 million rand, I'm happy to submit a report. How would you like that? Would you like it to come as a report? Should our report come and give a presentation? I'm happy either way. We did submit an affidavit to the Hawks. So I can submit that affidavit to the committee if you'd like to read that about what happened, what went wrong. In terms of the system failures, it wasn't our system that failed. It was APSA's. It was taken from an APSA account. It was 100% their responsibility, which is why they gave us all our money back. If it had been our systems, we wouldn't have got our money back from them. They'd have been, I'm sure you're aware, the banks are very loath to pay out money that they got if they can find a way not to. And for 57 million, I'm pretty sure they looked at a lot of ways not to pay that back, but they gave it back to us in the end. In terms of the dismissal of the previous supply chain manager, he departed late last year. I think it was October or November. I wasn't CFO at that stage or acting CEO, so I'm not sure exactly when he left, but once he left, we found that a lot of the root causes were areas where he didn't seem to understand the systems and processes, and we are now implementing changes to those. The Loss Control Committee's primary goal now is to ensure that root causes are actually addressed. It was originally set up, and it was actually making sure the consequence management was implemented, but in my view, consequence management is something that happens after the event. Loss control happens before the event, and that is where you address your root causes, and that is what we are busy doing now as an HFC through the Loss Control Committee and also the Executive Committee and the Audit Committee is keeping a close eye on what is happening there, and we're improving our reporting on irregular expenditure as well. I think that's all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair, I think most of all questions have been responded to. And I want to agree with Advocate Mkhize that some of the questions that were asked by Honourable Powell are not part of the Auditor General's report. But if you feel, Honourable Powell, that some of them are not answered the way you wanted, you can and put them in writing, as Advocate Mkhize said. I think Advocate Mkhize responded almost all questions that you've raised. But I do want to emphasize the issue of what you've raised of saying the board you are querying the board of qualifications of the board members. And I do want to tell you the processes that are there before you take the board member. I think it's undermining the whole system once you are referring to board members that are qualified, that have experience, and you are saying they're not qualified, they don't have experience. But my understanding is that the minister would take that to the cabinet, and that will also be looked at by the cabinet. And I want to assure you that the board which is there is 100% qualified and experienced. And I do want to say, Chair, let also advise that all committee concerns, comments and requests have been noted, and maybe there are those that we did not put more emphasis on.
but we can write and put them in writing. Our aim is to put in place preventive controls for long-term results, but mostly to avoid reoccurrences of the same issues in future. Naturally, we strive for effective cooperation governance, which will guarantee unqualified audit. But really, 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 it's an insult to say members of parliament, I mean members of the board that were appointed by the minister and are not qualified. For me, they are there and they will be there until their term expires. And I will hand over to the minister. And I think, Honourable Swai, I think all your answers I've checked, they are responded to. Mr. Gordon, thank you very much for your responses, and also Advocate Kize for your responses. I will now hand over to the minister. Thank you very much.
DM, I didn't see the minister on the system.
Let me again put on record, minister, that minister is not going to part of the meeting, not unless there is no cabinet. We all know that on Wednesday, it's cabinet meetings. We go there by invitation, and I'm also invited today. All DMs and ministers are in the cabinet, but because I respect this and decided among ourselves, the minister requested me to come to this meeting because we didn't want that meeting to both of us absent in the meeting. So I just want to put on record that not that the minister undermines or disrespects the committee, but it's very difficult for her on Wednesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DM. Honorable Power, is the follow-up?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And I note the Deputy Minister's comments in respect of written responses, but I do note that we still have 30 minutes left in committee. And I have got both comments and follow-ups that I would like to put to you in terms of Rule 167 of the Rules of the National Assembly read jointly with Rule 183. I've got four inputs still to make. Will you permit me, please, Chair?
We want to the follow-ups. Is it the follow-ups?
It's follow-ups and comments, yes. I'll be quick.
Okay,
cool. Advocate Mkhize, thank you so much for your robust responses. They are appreciated, and I do also note that you made quite a lot of effort to answer every question. I just have some follow-up specifically. So the comment that I would like to make is that we are 100% in support of transformation. Transformation, especially in the property sector in this country, is absolutely necessary. What I concern myself with as a member of parliament is the law and the application of the law. And just in terms of your responses on the executive management or managing agents, really, the mandate of CSIS, you quoted a whole bunch of different, you quoted the DHS annual performance plan, CSIS annual performance plan, a whole bunch of internal documents that look to performance. Then you spoke about the ministerial mandate. In terms of the CSIS Act, the ministerial mandate or any ministerial mandate must use surplus funds. So my question to you is, does CSIS have any surplus funds? And then just going on from that in terms of the directives, in terms of the BE criteria and so forth, I'd like to ask, so in the Western Cape, for example, only a single executive management agency was appointed. Are you confirming that there was only one bid that met with the specifications for the appointment of an EMA in the Western Cape? And then how can CSIS be tasked with transformation, but using stakeholder funds. And then you're an advocate yourself, so you obviously are aware of the recent constitutional court ruling that was between the Minister of Finance and AfriBusiness. And I just want to quote from that constitutional court ruling, and I quote section 125 of that judgment, where the judge's note or the ruling notes that essentially regulation making power does not enable an authority by regulations to extend the scope or the general operation of the enactment that is strictly ancillary. This would go for practice directives too. It will authorize the provision of subsidiary means of carrying into effect what is enacted in the statute or the legislation itself, and will cover what is incidental to the execution of its specific provisions. Now, CSOS is enacted in terms of the CSOS Act, right? So that's where you derive your mandate. So you can't come before Parliament and answer questions in respect of internal performance plans that have been developed internally that are not spoken to in either ministerial mandates where there are no surplus funds or in terms of internal annual performance plans. And then you'll also, my question to you is, what impact does the recent Constitutional Court judgment on preferential procurement regulations have in terms of, for example, the bids that were offered on the executive management agencies? Again, I say this for in the context of us having general support for transformation, but being concerned here in this forum with the application of the law in the entities that account to this committee. Then just quickly on Poppy, Chairperson, this is becoming a really big issue. And what CSOS is informing schemes to do is it's going to end up in the courts. And what I understand of it, Advocate and Keys, and now I'd really like to understand this, is that CSOS's stance on the application of the Protection of Personal Information Act is informed by, I understand, instructions from the information regulator. And I know that CSOS has been in discussions with the information regulator and was of the view that the contact details of owners within schemes can only now be made available to other owners within the same scheme upon the consent of the owner whose details are being requested. And in the context of sectional titles, this is massively problematic, because apart from anything else, it can potentially prevent owners from calling general meetings, as is their right in terms of Management Rule 17.4.A. And body corporates simply can't function if members can't get the names and the contact details of their owners. And then I'd also like to draw your attention, and perhaps you can answer my question in respect of Poppy itself, draw your attention to Section 11.1F of Poppy, which in my view applies to trustees and members of all body corporates. And I will just read to you what that says. But essentially it says, this is Poppy, consent, justification, and objection. This is section 11. Personal information may only be processed if, and then there's A, B, C, D, E, if processing is necessary for pursuing the legitimate interests of the responsible party or of a third party to whom information is supplied. And then Poppy goes on in other sections that I can send to you to list a whole bunch of exemptions in terms of the extent and the application. And then again, as an advocate, you would understand that legislation on a concomitant level cannot vary existing legislation without that being repealed, right? So Poppy can't be used as a justification by CSOS and their adjudicators. And this is where I come to the comments that I've made in respect of the training and the expertise and the industry knowledge of the adjudicators that are being appointed by CSOS. Poppy can't be used as an excuse not to provide schemes or an excuse by schemes not to provide owners and members with information that they need to function in terms of the entire purpose of the CSOS Act. I was going to speak about the legislation and the amendments as a member advocate in Kyiv, you would be aware that we're very well versed in the process that is followed in developing, passing and promulgating legislation. So, but thank you very much for the pointers that you gave to us. The query and the concern isn't that CSOS doesn't have the mandate to start looking at amendments. Rather, it is that the public are being told that amendments to these acts are imminent. And that are forthcoming, and that actually, in reality, it's still just in the very initial think tank phases. And I think that that's where my office is certainly getting panicked queries and concerns from stakeholders who are saying, CSOS is telling us these amendments are imminent. And we're kind of going, okay, well, there's a long process that they still need to follow. So I think that the point really is that perhaps the senior executives at CSOS should just refrain from making emboldened statements in respect of potential amendments, and rather say that, you know, we're looking at varying the legislation, amendments in consultation with the minister, cabinet, etc. Because I think it's spooking some of the industry players quite a lot, but that's besides the point. Thank you for the lesson that you gave to us in terms of the passage of legislation. That's all, Chairperson. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honourable Powell. I just left you to raise the matter. The meeting was set to end at 12:30. So, but I'm now going to allow Honorable Mkhize to and the DM and the team to respond so that we close the meeting. So the 30 minutes that you're talking about is not today. I just want to correct that. The meeting was set to be 9:30 to 12:30. DM and the team.
Sure, thank you very much. Let me start with Advocate Mkhize, then I will also allow DDG Ngongo to say something on issues that were raised by Honorable Power, and then I'll come after them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, and Honourable Members, and to Honourable Member Powell, the ministerial mandate. First of all, I mean, I think we're just happy to acknowledge that Member Powell is in fact pro transformation, and that there is actually recognition of the fact that the property sector actually requires some extensive transformation in this regard. So I think that's a great positive step forward in terms of us at least being aligned from an objectives point of view. The minister has got a mandate in respect of the sector that she leads to actually issue out certain directives, impose targets. I made reference to this in terms of our own act, that is Section 5. So that authority of the minister cannot be questioned. And it derives from other national imperatives that I alluded to earlier on. I don't need to repeat that. But it's a cascading system. And each of the entities are within the confines of what they are responsible for, and we're responsible for community schemes and community schemes administration and management, have to actually take those mandates and then apply them into their own context and address the transformation national imperatives. And this is why you see this being reflected then in the annual performance plans. It is also important to note that Section 5 gives the minister that authority. And I can confirm that, yes, the CSOS does have surplus funds. And those surplus funds can be utilized in a manner as directed by the minister to advance the programs, amongst others, such as this one. And that is clearly articulated in the legislation. There's no expansion of the power of the minister in this regard. It is actually a legislative power and authority that's vested in the executive authority to actually make those pronouncements. And those pronouncements have been made. They are industry-wide. They pertain to transformation of the sector. I take note of the issue of the Concord judgment in terms of the regulation powers not having to supersede those of the legislative frameworks. And that's not what is being done here. In fact, the authority of the minister is actually being exercised within the confines of that particular authority, which derives directly from legislation. There is no contradiction whatsoever. And the Concord judgment reference, therefore, would not apply in this regard. Minister number one has not extended her powers beyond legislation. Two, she has not published regulations that can actually be deemed to be inconsistent with the legislation, which is the empowering provision or empowering legislation. And so the context is slightly different in this regard. Yes, it is correct, in fact, to say that the there was a response only from one entity in the Western Cape. So as I said earlier on, it was not of our doing. We continue to solicit more participation because the economic transformation agenda is about mobilizing and ensuring that there is mass participation in relation to this. Now, the issue around and I see Member Powell is pointing me to some of the areas in the Constitutional Court judgment. And I think understood in context, I don't want to debate this legal conjunctions here around or injunctions around the Constitutional Court judgment. But I don't think that understood correctly and contextually that the Constitutional Court was saying there is no cause for transformation, there is no cause for BEE, there is no cause for advancing those that were historically disadvantaged. The Constitution, in fact, talks to this. And it talks about, unfair discrimination, which is a qualification. This is a debate that we can embark upon. And it says unfair discrimination. It makes that distinction because there is the realization that in fact there can be fair discrimination. And if there is legislation that is enacted to address the legacy of the past, employment equity is one such legislation. That legislation has not been set aside. It is in fact a reality in relation to what we have to deal with. So the Constitutional Court has not said that's the end of transformation, that's the end of advancing people from historically disadvantaged communities. The manner in which it was done in that particular instance by Minister of Finance is what was at issue before the Concord. That's a subject for another day, but essentially we do not find that there is any discord between what we are seeking to do in advancing the cause of the previously disadvantaged in the property sector, in line with the ministerial directives, in line with national imperatives that have been set from cabinet, from National Assembly downwards to the entities that are there. The Poppy thing with regards to, I'm going to look into this, Member Powell, based on in terms of the implications around member details. But I think you are correct in saying that if there are details that are required for a specific purpose, to pursue a legitimate purpose, in terms of it's one of the exceptions. And the question is, what is that legitimate purpose and how is it defined? So we need to look into our practices with regards to the arrangements that the members of the various schemes subject themselves to. In the form of their constitutions, in the form of their scheme rules, in the form of anything that seeks to regulate AGMs and related issues, collection of levies, etc., the extent to which those may in fact be frustrated if there is strict adherence to the POPI and in terms of withholding the information. However, where consent has not been provided, it is important for us to understand those issues cannot be overridden by anyone. But I'm happy to look into that area. Finally, the issue around imminent amendments, I'm not sure who Member Powell listens to and why those messaging should actually be taken as the correct position, to put it mildly. And a suggestion that executives are talking about imminent, I'm not sure why that should be taken as law, because there are processes that, you know, go through these things. And so I think we can discuss that at a later stage. But we are happy to engage if there are any practical difficulties that the scheme members might be experiencing, even with regards to POPI, we're happy to look into that. I will, in fact, personally look into the area so that we can issue much more clearer practice directives around that area of POPI. Thank you so much.
DG and the Minister. DG and the Minister.
Yes, I'm not quite sure before that, Chair, whether the DG, because he said to me he will connect, whether you are here, DG, or not, before I give to DG Ngongo. No, he's not
here. I'm here, DM. I just joined 10 minutes ago when Advocate Ikize was speaking. I'll hand over to you because I've missed the bigger part of the discussion.
Okay.
Thanks, DM.
Let me then give DG Ngongo to make comments.
Thank you, DM. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We have taken note on the areas of improvement as being guided by the committee. We will certainly improve in those areas. But let me also indicate that we're quite comfortable with the stability that the minister is providing at our entities, that our entities will live up to the expectation, starting from the appointments of the boards and the executives, as I've indicated earlier on. And our entities, they've got the full support of the department to improve in all the areas that the Auditor General has highlighted. And we are committed to address the root causes so that we do not have the repeat findings. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Chair, let me thank you for the opportunity to present today. And I also want to thank the two presenters that presented and their responses to members of parliament. And I do want to tell the committee that every time we come to the committee, there is something that we learn. And I want to agree with DG Ngongo that we will adhere to all the comments or anything that you advise on. We will actually go and work on it. We will improve. And I do want to say, Chair, you've taken a lot of your time and trying to advise us. And we're not taking the questions and the comments raised lightly. We are taking them seriously. And I do want to say other issues that were raised that are not in the SG's AG's report, I think if there are any of that you would want us to respond on, we will actually put them in writing. But so far, it looks like Advocate Kize has done his best to answer most of the questions that are there. We'll only have our hiccups because when we work, you sometimes make mistakes on the way. We'll correct ourselves, and I do want to thank everyone for your time. Thank you very much. Thank the DGs and the DG for their support. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm now handing over to you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, TM, and the entities that we are engaging on the action plan to respond to Auditor General outcome. And thank the Auditor General for having stayed with us
as we are interacting with the department, and we are doing what we promised that we are going to do to make sure that we get the clean audit. And through yourselves, through your hard work, that's where we must actually, all of us, will tide ourselves immediately. If you there is an announcement that you got the clean audit, and even you would know that we're still going to engage with other entities. Don't wait for the portfolio committee to call those entities. Department, continue to do your good work in monitoring and assisting those entities to deal with issues that Auditor General has raised, because they are fundamental in making sure that there is an accountability and service delivery to our people, because where we don't take serious on compliance and implementation of our act as we passed as passed by Parliament, it's something that as members of Parliament would not appreciate, because this act are passed for department to implement, and the Auditor General simply just say you have passed this legislation and there is no compliance on them. And all of us, we have responsibility to make sure that we comply, work with the Auditor General to make sure that there is that service delivery, because where there is no compliance, it will affect service delivery, because we'll be distracted in doing what we're supposed to do. And we want to thank you very much, and CISOs and the NHFC, yeah, please continue to correct yourselves. When we come for strategic planning, we'll take some of the discussion further, like issues that were raised by honorable members, which need for further discussion. We want to thank you very much for availing yourself to and the meeting stand adjourned.
Long live Chair. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning.
Thank you.